Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Michael Bryant, Associate Professor in the Department of History and Social Sciences at Bryant University in Smithfield, Rhode Island, and author of Confronting the Good Death, Nazi Euthanasia on Trial, 1945 to 1954. He'll deliver the International Law Lecture, co-sponsored by the Creighton International and Comparative Law Journal and International Law Society. His topic will be Eyewitness to Genocide, the Operation Reinhardt Death Camp Trials, 1955 to 1966. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, April 9, 2015, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Michael Kelly, Associate Dean for Faculty Research and Graduate and International Programs at the Creighton University School of Law.
Welcome, everybody, to our semi-annual International Law Lecture. It's semi-annual because we grab the brightest stars in the constellation of international law whenever we can get them, and sometimes that's not every year. But I will say that our first international law lecture was in this room at this podium back in 1978, and Professor Ron Volkmer will remember who that was. It was a professor named Lewis Henkin, and he came out and gave a lecture, the inaugural international law lecture here, 4 years after the building was built. He went on to be the rapporteur for the U.S. Restatement of Foreign Relations, third edition. So you guys are citing that if you're doing anything with the International Law Journal. And Lewis was here in that room at that time as he was getting ready to go into that monumental project. Today we have Dr. Michael Bryant, and he's going to be delivering a lecture on the Operation Reinhardt trials, which is the subject of his book. But before we get into that and before we get into the substance of that presentation, I want to call on Håkon Aldrich to come say a few words about our International and Comparative Law Journal, who is hosting this event. So, Håkon, Editor-in-Chief.
Thanks, guys. Well, thank you, everybody, for coming. I'd like to thank the International Law Journal's Board of Editors, the International Law Society, and Dean Kelly for helping set this all up. The Creighton International and Comparative Law Journal is only seven years old. It's relatively new. But in the six-year legacy that we've had, we've managed to publish a wide range of topics on international and comparative law from professionals, professors, and students from around the world. We hope to continue that tradition. We've also started to bring in professors to talk about some of these issues. The International Law Society, Elizabeth, has helped very much in setting that up this year. We look to continue that tradition as well. So we'll let this get started. Thanks again for coming, everyone.
Professor Mike Bryant is a professor of history and social sciences and German history at Bryant University in Rhode Island. He received his PhD and his MA from Ohio State University, as well as his BA. He received his JD and his master's in theology from the Chandler School at Emory University. He was instrumental in sitting down 6 years ago with myself and Professor Sean Watts to create our Nuremberg program in Germany every summer in the month of July. And in that month, we teach two classes for six credits that focus on the Holocaust, war crimes, genocide, crimes against humanity. Why Nuremberg? Why did we choose Nuremberg? Very simple, because Justice Robert Jackson chose Nuremberg. In 1945, we found ourselves with several high-ranking Nazi leaders that we wanted to put on trial for their crimes against the world. Justice Jackson took a year's leave from the U.S. Supreme Court, if you can imagine that today, and invested himself in creating a fair tribunal system to deal with these men. He chose Nuremberg because Nuremberg was the heart and soul of National Socialism. This is where Hitler really founded the Nazi movement in the middle of Bavaria. And symbolically, it was important that an end note be placed in that spot. So we go to Nuremberg for symbolic reasons. We go to Nuremberg because we have friends in the German government and German academia that help us host this program. And it has been a tremendous success. We're moving into our fourth year now. Our ABA accreditors have declared our program the most comprehensive themed summer program they've encountered. And there are at easily 100 ABA programs around the world. So that's a huge compliment. And it's in no small part thanks to the efforts of Dr. Michael Bryant, who is fluent in German, which is one of the requirements for the program, and is a student of German legal history as well. One of the pieces of business that I need to take care of today before we have Dr. Bryant come to the podium is the presentation of an award. There is a society of academics, jurists, lawyers, defense counsel that deal with international criminal law that has been around since 1924. This is the International Penal Law Association, or the French word, since it's headquartered in Paris, L'Association Internationale du Droit Pénal. Michael and I are privileged to be members of this society. They have consultative status with the United Nations. They convene every 5 years in an international congress to actually define new areas of international criminal law. Every year, our society selects a book by one of our members to receive its Book of the Year award. And this year they have selected Dr. Bryant's book. And so I have this plaque from the International Association of Penal Law, the 2015 Book of the Year Award for Scholarly Contribution to the Field, Michael Bryant, author of Eyewitness to Genocide, the Operation Reinhard Death Camp Trials, 1955 to 1966. Michael, it's my honor to present you this plaque. And with that, I will turn the podium over to you.
Thank you very much, Dean Kelly. It's a real pleasure to be with everybody today. A lot of familiar faces in the audience from earlier N2H sessions. Elizabeth, right? Molly, a few others out there. I've been working for Creighton now this is my fourth year, Mike, right? It's my first time to actually set foot on Creighton's campus. So I've been an adjunct professor here for 4 years, and at long last I found an opportunity to spend some time with you. I'd like to begin my presentation today with a question, and I will throw this open to you and kind of draw you into my presentation a bit here. When you think of the Holocaust, what image comes to mind? Try to frame it inside your mind's eye insofar as you can. What image do you think of? The infamous gate at Auschwitz-Birkenau, Auschwitz number 2, as it's called. For those of you, and I know there are a few in the audience who are coming to Nuremberg in July with us, you will be coming to Krakow. We spend several days in Krakow, and in conjunction with the Krakow trip, we make a special excursion to the Auschwitz camp, right? And we go, we spend a couple of hours at Auschwitz I, which was the Stammlager, the headquarters, the administrative center of the camp, before we then take a malodorous and very hot bus. you know of what I speak, Elizabeth, don't you? To Auschwitz II, on the infamous railways or rail lines leading through the main gate into Auschwitz-Birkenau. Just beyond the gate, of course, was the unloading platform, which you can walk, in which Mike and I and other students who participated walked for a good, half mile, roughly? I think that this is probably the image that many of you, raise your hands, I'd be curious, when you think of Holocaust, isn't this kind of the quintessential image that so many people have? Why is this the case? Why do you think of Auschwitz? I would like to suggest a number of reasons why this image of the gate at Auschwitz has become the archetype, the malevolent archetype of Nazi crimes. First off, there were actually quite a few survivors of the Auschwitz camp. Keep in mind that Auschwitz was not a pure extermination camp. Right? There was actually a labor camp, a rubber and synthetic gasoline camp also co-located with the extermination camp. Auschwitz II was the extermination wing of the Auschwitz complex. But for the first several years of Auschwitz's existence, it wasn't even a death camp, it was a labor camp, right? And a camp in which resistant Poles were re-educated, i.e. terrorized. Some 1.6 million people were killed at Auschwitz. Of that number, about 1.3 million were Jewish. But upwards of 2 million people were deported there over the course of its existence as both a labor camp and as a death camp. How many of that number survived? Does anyone know what the survival, the total number of people who survived Auschwitz was? Maybe you think that nobody survived, right? But in fact, quite a few people did. 65,000 survived the Auschwitz camp. Well, what happened to these people who survived the war? They returned home insofar as there was a home to return to. Others emigrated. Some came to the United States. Some came to Canada. Some went to Venezuela. Many emigrated to Israel when Israel was founded as a nation state. But wherever they went, they talked about their experiences. Many granted interviews, which were then written up in newspapers. Others wrote books. Some of them returned in 1945 and 1946 to testify against accused Nazi war criminals. For example, Marie-Claude Vaillant-Couturier, right, is a member of the French Resistance, was eventually arrested and sent to Auschwitz. She appeared in Nuremberg and testified as a witness against the defendants, and she described her experiences at Auschwitz. Already in 1945, 1946, when the world was still reeling from the disclosures of the existence of this camp, people like Marie-Claude Vaillant-Couturier were describing their experiences at Auschwitz. And she talked about seeing firsthand the gassing of the Jews in Auschwitz-Birkenau. And she talked about another subject which continues to arouse disgust and shock even today at a remove of 70 years, namely the medical experiments which were conducted at Auschwitz. But it wasn't just Auschwitz survivors who testified at Nuremberg. So did some of the former perpetrators who had Auschwitz connections. And I'm thinking in particular here of, can you fill in the blank, N2H alumni, what major Auschwitz figure testified on behalf of the defense? It actually wound up hurting the defense. But anyone recall how short are the memories? Right? Remember Rudolf Hirsch? Does that name ring a bell? Yeah. Rudolf Hirsch was one of several commandants of the Auschwitz camp. Probably the most infamous one, in part because he appeared at Nuremberg and testified about the purposes of the camp. So already at a very tender stage of historical memory across the world, Auschwitz is being increasingly identified as a symbol of Nazi extermination in 1945 and 1946. No mention was made of other death camps at the time. There was some discussion of the concentration camps like Dachau and Bergen-Belsen and some of the others. Those were not extermination camps, though. There were no references to Sobibor or to Treblinka or to Belzec or to Kelmno, or to Majdanek, right, where millions of Jews and other groups too, like the Roma and the Sinti, were exterminated. And this is true also for many of the other trials held by other national groups, whether it was the Americans at Nuremberg, or the British in their royal warrant trials, or the French, who were really wrapped up with trying to identify people, Frenchmen and French women who had collaborated with the Germans during the occupation of France, or other national groups. There was hardly any mention made of these other death camps. And this is true in Eastern Europe as well. And Poland is ground zero of the Holocaust. You probably all know that already, right? Most of the Holocaust, especially when it comes to gas chambers and death camps, was conducted in Poland. So the Poles conducted their own series of trials in front of a specially constituted court called the Supreme National Tribunal. It's sometimes referred to as Poland's Nuremberg. Supreme National Tribunal, which prosecuted several fairly high-ranking Nazi officials. People like Rudolf Hirsch. Hirsch testifies at Nuremberg and then is sent back to Poland, where he is put on trial before this Supreme National Tribunal, charged with what? What do you think the Poles charged him with? They did. They charged him with genocide. Was genocide charged at Nuremberg, by the way? It was not, right? Oh, my. The memories come back. Professor Bryant is very gratified, right? Yeah, Nuremberg did not charge the offense of genocide. Instead, they charged Nazi mass murder and racial killing as crimes against humanity, right? It was felt that there wasn't enough of a legal basis at the time for genocide. It was a term coined, of course, by Raphael Lemkin already in 1943. So there was a feeling by the Nuremberg architects that it was just too undeveloped. So they charged with crimes against humanity instead. The Poles had no such compunction in their charging of Nazi war criminals. They charged them with crimes against humanity. They charged them with war crimes. They charged them with mass murder. And they charged them with genocide. But the defendants, at least those who were from death camps, hailed from Auschwitz, not from Majdanek, Kelmno, Belzec, Sobibor, Treblinka. All those camps were on Polish soil, as was Auschwitz. And yet hardly any reference in these immediate post-war trials was made to these other camps. And furthermore, the material structure of Auschwitz survived the war. You can see it even today. The infamous Gate Tower is still in existence. It hasn't been torn down. Right? You can go to Auschwitz I, which some of you who are coming with us this summer will do. And you can see Auschwitz I, the administrative center of the camp, pretty much as it looked when the Red Army arrived in January of 1945 to liberate the camp. Right? Most of it is entirely intact. Okay. And so the physical nature of the camp is still, to this day, a living, visible symbol of Nazi inhumanity. Okay. Not so the other death camps, in the Operation Reinhard camps, for example, Treblinka, Sobibor, and Belzec. What happened to those camps? They were all torn down. Yeah, they were torn to pieces by Sonderkommando 1005. Remember, this is an SS group formed under Paul Blobel for the express purpose of moving into the camps and tearing them to pieces. For what purpose? In order to erase any vestige of the death camps. They weren't able to do it with Auschwitz. They simply ran out of time. The Red Army was approaching, and they had to get out of town very quickly. So Auschwitz survives. These other camps do not. They're torn to pieces very quickly. And so, when it came time to do the Treblinka trial, when it came to pictorial representations of the Treblinka camp, the court had to have recourse to crudely drawn maps. Now, at roughly the same time as the Treblinka trial in 1964 in West Germany, there was another proceeding unfolding in Frankfurt, targeting the Auschwitz death camp, which in fact was the largest trial ever conducted in West Germany and remains to this day the largest trial ever conducted in West Germany. More people overall died in Auschwitz, certainly, than these other camps. But the most lethal of the camps were camps like Treblinka. And yet there was no material trace of the camp. There was no opportunity to take members of the court, as was done at the Auschwitz proceeding, to the camp to inspect the grounds. If you had gone, you would not have been able to find anything except, you know, traces of rock and stone, maybe a few tablets that had been erected to memorialize the event. But there was no material trace of the camp really left, as there is with Auschwitz. So I think this may be another reason why the Auschwitz camp has become this archetypal symbol. There was a symbol, a visible symbol that could be identified, unlike the other death camps in Poland. Auschwitz, of course, was also around for a much longer period of time. It existed as a German camp for about 5 years. For around 2 to 3 of those years, it was a labor camp, a forced labor or slave labor camp. And then for 2 to 3 years, it was a death camp. So it was in existence far longer than the other death camps, which were around for 1.5 to 2 years before they were finally dismantled. In terms of the total number of victims, Auschwitz is the king, right? 1.6 million killed at Auschwitz, so it's surpassing the other most lethal camp, which was Treblinka, 700,000 plus. But in terms of the lethality of the camp, these other death camps were far, far more dangerous places even than Auschwitz was. Does anyone know what the survival rate at Auschwitz proved to be? What was your chance of surviving if you were deported to Auschwitz, say after 1942? What were your chances of surviving? About 16%. Right? 65,000 survivors, right? Well, consider Chełmno, not an Operation Reinhard camp, by the way, but nonetheless, a major death camp, 149,000 people deported there. One survivor of the 149,000. Belzec, Operation Reinhard camp, 600,000 people deported there. Two survivors. Sobibor, it's a little controversial, but the best estimate, 152,000 people deported to Sobibor. How many survivors? 30, but only because there was a prison outbreak toward the end, and 30 of the prisoners managed to escape and to elude recapture and to survive the war. Similarly, with Treblinka, more than 700,000 Jews deported to Treblinka. Of this number, 70 survived, again, because of a prison breakout toward the end of its existence. What does this mean in practical effect and for the success of future trials? It means that you're going to have far fewer witnesses available, right? Available to prosecute and to sustain convictions of the Nazi war criminals at those camps. And in fact, Operation Reinhard was not even recognized as a distinct and self-contained program of the Holocaust, of the Final Solution, as it's sometimes called, until several years after the war. Not until 1951 did the West Germans begin their first prosecution of an Operation Reinhard Guard. And those are just sporadic and individual cases. Awareness of the existence of Operation Reinhard did not begin until the late 1940s, when West German authorities were investigating crimes committed against the mentally disabled in Germany. And as they did so, they kept stumbling across references to camps that they didn't even know existed. Camps in the East where, according to individuals suspected of killing the mentally handicapped, Jews were being put to death. But little, in fact, was really done about Treblinka and Sobibor and Belzec until the late 1950s. Today, I'd like to talk a little bit about one of the investigations and one of the trials focusing upon the Operation Reinhard camps, namely the Treblinka death camp. And I want to explore how it is that the West German authorities developed their case against the defendants from 1959 until the indictment was rendered in 1963. The case went to trial in 1964. A massive trial, dwarfed only by the parallel Auschwitz proceeding. It would last nearly a year. 180 witnesses will be heard, both in Dusseldorf, where the trial was held, but also throughout the world. It was a movable feast, this trial, right? It went all over the place trying to locate survivor witnesses and to have them testify. They would hear stories from survivors. They would listen to unindicted co-conspirators. They would hear testimony from former SS judges. And I want to talk a little bit about this trial, because by the end of the trial, when the verdict was finally pronounced, it had become arguably the most successful prosecution in West Germany of death camp trials, and remains to this day, I would defend, the most successful prosecution of death camp guards in German history. It convicted nearly all the defendants and dealt out lengthy prison terms to them. Keep in mind, there's no capital punishment in Germany, right? So it was the most severe punishment could be given under German law. So my aim is to tell this story today. As it turns out, the Treblinka death camp was one of the early investigations conducted by the Central Office. Now, the Central Office was a special investigative unit formed in 1958 for the express purpose of investigating and compiling documentation from crimes committed by the National Socialist government in Eastern Europe. Formed in 1958, and it really became the essential investigator of Nazi crimes. Once they compiled their files, they would send these files on then to district attorneys throughout Germany, who would then have responsibility for preferring charges and rendering indictments against the accused. As they built their case against Treblinka and against other death camp guards, they had recourse to a number of sources of information. One of these, interestingly enough, were the Israelis. There's a history here that is worth talking about, and I can't talk very much about it during my lecture. I don't have time. But as it turns out, the West Germans and the Israelis were deeply connected in investigating, in a collaborative manner, details about the Holocaust, locating potential defendants and perpetrators, as well as compiling lists of survivors and witnesses. Many of the survivors of the Holocaust were living at the time in Israel. And so for this reason, the West Germans, as they embark upon their first really serious confrontation with the final solution, at least from a judicial standpoint, had to have access to survivor testimony in order to successfully prosecute the accused. These contacts go back really to the abduction and trial of Adolf Eichmann, perhaps the most important single trial, arguably, Holocaust-related trial over the past 60 years worldwide. Eichmann was abducted in Argentina, where he had been in hiding. How is it that the Israelis were able to locate his whereabouts? He was living under an alias, Ricardo Clement, right? So how were they able to find him? We now know that the judicial president of the court in Frankfurt, a man named Fritz Bauer, is now believed to have provided the information to the Israelis that led them to Eichmann. The West Germans, in other words, enabling the Israelis to find Eichmann. It's quite an irony when you think about it. But the Israelis and the West Germans worked very closely and very collaboratively. And Yad Vashem and the Israeli police and the Mossad all worked with West German investigators, especially from that central office in Ludwigsburg, providing them with the names of survivors living not just in Israel, but in other parts of the world, and in some cases providing the West Germans with affidavits from these survivor witnesses. So this became a very important source of information. Another source of evidence was this earlier trial from 1951 involving this man, Joseph Hirtreiter. Joseph Hirtreiter was tried in Frankfurt in 1951. He was tried alone. He was not tried in company with other co-defendants. He had initially been accused of murdering the mentally disabled in the 1940s, but investigators were not able to prove their case against him, and he was acquitted in his trial. But then he was re-indicted and tried in 1951 because he had confessed to being a guard in this earlier proceeding, being a guard at the Treblinka camp. He didn't even call it Treblinka, though. He called it Malkinia. But of course, there was a substantial documentation produced by the trial record in the course of investigating and trying this case. And the central office investigators tapped into this information. They found a verbatim account of a Treblinka survivor who implicated an SS man named Kurt Franz in atrocities committed in the camp. Trial records also contained the names of other survivor witnesses from Treblinka. And many of these people would later then be rounded up, they'd be found, and they provided testimony then against Kurt Franz and other of his co-defendants at their 1964 trial. These included people like Alfred Mitte and Willy Mintz. Mitte and Mintz are sitting on the far right of the table. What do you see in this photograph from the 1940s? What does it look like? Yeah, drinking beer, right? Looks like a picnic, I think, doesn't it? In fact, that's what it is. It's an outing of the administrative personnel, at least a segment of them, from the T4 program. T4 was the program to exterminate the mentally handicapped of Germany. Right? So this is an outing. You can see the mountain in the background, a bucolic setting for to sit around and drink beer and eat sausage, right? Which is what they're doing here. The two men on the far right, August Mitte and Willy Mintz, will also be indicted in 1963 and tried alongside Kurt Franz. I think this photograph is quite meaningful, and I include it in my book for a reason. I not only wanted to show my readers the faces of some of the perpetrators, but I wanted to underscore the close connection between the T4 program and what eventually happened in Poland. There was around 94 of the former T4 staff were reassigned in the fall of 1941 and then the winter of 1942 and sent to the Lublin district of Poland, where they became involved then in administering the death camps. The focus of the Treblinka investigation and then later the Treblinka trial, however, was firmly on this man, Kurt Franz. Until 1967, Kurt Franz was the only Operation Reinhardt commandant to be tried in a West German courtroom. In 1967, Franz Stangl will be extradited from Brazil, will eventually be placed on trial and convicted, will eventually die of cancer in jail. But until that time, Kurt Franz was the only commandant to be tried in West Germany. He was born in Dusseldorf. joined the SS in 1937, and was assigned to the 3rd SS Death's Head Regiment, Thuringia. He was later stationed in Frankenberg and then in Weimar. And during his time in Weimar, he served as a guard at the Buchenwald camp. You probably have heard of Buchenwald. It was liberated by the Americans. It's one of several concentration camps the Americans liberated in 1945. In fall of 1939, he was then assigned to the T4 program and sent to several of the killing centers of the mentally disabled in Germany. Insofar as we can tell, based on the documentation from his trial, he worked there as a cook. Although I personally am skeptical that he spent all of his time in the kitchen. Why? Because in April 1942, he is sent from the killing program, the T4 program, to the Lublin district and placed under the command of Odilo Globachnik. Odilo Globachnik was the SS police leader for the Lublin district, who was entrusted with organizing Operation Reinhardt. Operation Reinhardt was the plan, dating back to September, October 1941, to exterminate all of the general government's Jewish population, consisting of 2,284,000 Jews. You can think of Operation Reinhardt as being a piece of the mosaic of the Holocaust. Right? It's a distinct program targeting Jews, primarily in Poland. And the killing would be executed in death camps with stationary gas chambers, unlike other killing operations the Nazis carried out. So Franz is sent to the Lublin district to work with Globachnik, organizing Operation Reinhardt. The reason I'm skeptical that Franz was just a cook at the T4 centers is this. Why would he have been reassigned as a technician of mass murder unless he had proven his mettle in an earlier program? And I think that's probably what he did. We just don't have a lot of documentation on it. Well, he worked at Belzec from April until midsummer of 1942 and then was transferred to Treblinka. And once he arrives in Treblinka, he becomes the deputy commandant and then eventually the commandant. After the war, he was interned by the Americans in Thuringia. He manages to escape custody, however, and returns to Dusseldorf, where, between 1949 and 1959, he works as a cook. I had mentioned earlier that the central office had delved into the documentation from the Joseph Hirtereiter trial from 1951. This documentation revealed Franz as a sadist in his work in Treblinka. And this is an image that was repeatedly confirmed by witnesses during the investigation. For example, a witness named Wolf Seinberg testified at the trial. He was a jeweler from Warsaw who had been transported to Treblinka in July of 1942. We'll talk about the deportation of Warsaw's Jews here in just a bit. When Seinberg arrived on the platform, he saw Franz, whom he called Lalka, A-L-A-L-K-A, Lalka, which is a Polish word meaning doll. Why did Franz earn this title, this name, nickname of Doll? Seems like an unusual name for a sadistic mass murderer in a concentration camp. It's because of his appearance, right? If you take a look at him, a fairly well-groomed man, right? By the way, how can you tell that he's SS? Just by the photograph itself. Yeah, the SS runes dead giveaway on the collar. How do you know he works in a concentration camp or death camp? You see the emblem on the skull and crossbones on the cap. My students from last year, remember our trip to Krakow? What did you see in the market for sale in some of the kiosks? Remember, Andrew? Yeah, I can't remember how much they were asking for it, but it was a 300. It's a lot. Yeah, 300 euros, so $450, something like that. Yeah, I caution some of the students that you've got to be careful. If you wind up buying this World War II memorabilia, a lot of it is illegal in Germany. So if you You buy it there, you come back to Germany, and they find in the airport that you bought it, you might be in some trouble, right? Caveat emptor, right? So Zeynberg takes the stand, testifies against Franz. He says he arrives on the platform. There Franz was with his dog, Barry. I'll be talking about Barry here in a few minutes. Very important in the trial, interestingly enough. The most important dog in all of Holocaust judicial history is definitely Barry, the Treblinka camp guard. Well, Zeynberg saw Franz on the platform. He also saw a friend of his on the platform. This friend greeted Zeynberg and told him that the deportees, these recently arrived people on the train, including Zeynberg, stood a chance of surviving if they went to the right instead of to the left. And that rumor must have swept through the people on the unloading platform because they begin kind of drifting over toward the right. At the same time, Franz is barking out orders, telling them to go left. They didn't respond to the orders. He pulls out his whip and begins lashing these recently arrived people on the platform, and then takes out his gun and just begins shooting indiscriminately into the crowd, just shooting several of the deportees dead. Another witness against Franz, and there were many of them, I'm just providing a sampling of some of the testimony, was Eliash Rosenberg. Rosenberg was an extremely important witness against Eichmann. As it turns out, Rosenberg was among the most accurate and perceptive of the witnesses at the Treblinka trial. He is a Polish Jew from Warsaw who, after the war, had immigrated to Israel. At Eichmann's trial in Tel Aviv, he testified about the layout of the Treblinka camp. You can see part of the mock-up in the background of the Rosenberg picture, right? Again, you have to have this information because there's no material remains of the camp. The camp had been destroyed in 1943. So Zeynberg, along with some other witnesses, were able to reconstruct the camp. In Dusseldorf, Rosenberg's testimony was badly, badly damaging to Franz. And what made Rosenberg such a good witness, and keep this in mind, you future criminal lawyers or prosecutors, he was able to recall with frightful clarity, details of specific events that Franz was involved in. And he could not only identify days of the month in which Franz had committed his crimes, he could also identify the names and the identities of Franz's victims, so that the victims were no longer, you know, the nameless and faceless dead, as they so often are in these kinds of trials, but they were living and breathing people, right, with human faces. And Rosenberg was able to humanize the trial in a way that was quite exceptional. Another witness who bore testimony against Franz was this gentleman, Kalman Teichman. Kalman Teichman, of course, during the war, was a robust and young man, a mechanic from Warsaw, who worked as a forced laborer in a repair service for Daimler-Benz. In September of 1942, he was sent in a boxcar to Treblinka, along with 6,000 other Polish Jews. Nearly all of these people were gassed on arrival, except for Teichman and just a small handful of his co-deportees. They were singled out and spared as work Jews, Arbeitsjude in German. It was not unusual for the SS to use a certain remnant of the deportations to do, you know, unpleasant work the SS did not want to do in the camp, and they did so, of course, at the on the threat of to their very lives at the barrel of a gun. But nonetheless, he was exempted and given a lease on life after his deportation. He was assigned to sorting valuables in Treblinka 1. Which was a labor camp co-located with the extermination camp. And then he was sometimes active in working on the train platform, assisting with the unloading of the rail cars. During the pretrial investigation, Teichman testified about an event that was very, very important to Francis' conviction, namely Francis' shooting of 30 of the work Jews on the unloading platform in November of 1943, in full view of everybody on the platform. Now, Franz was obviously not the only defendant, the only person accused by the witnesses. So were other co-defendants, other colleagues of Franz's from the camp. But very clearly, from the beginning of the investigation as well as the beginning of the trial, Franz was the focus of the case. In January of 1963, Franz and 13 of his fellow guards and camp staff were indicted by the Dusseldorf prosecutor's office. The trial began then in October of 1964. The judges thought that the trial would last only 44 business days. They thought it would wrap up in mid-January 1965. But instead, it went on and on and on and did not wrap up until September of 1965. So about 11 months. I want to provide you with just a kind of a brushstroke of some of the major events of the trial. If you are interested in further details, I would recommend my book to you. I have a chapter on the Treblinka trial. These are just some of the events that are chronicled. From day one, Franz demonstrated his combative personality. He snorted in contempt when the charges were read. He was boorish and rude throughout the first day of the trial. He also raised a defense that he had not been in the camp until October 2nd of 1943 and only stayed until the following October of 1942 until 1943. And he claimed, in other words, not to have been in the camp at a time when genocide was peaking. Right, especially with the deportation of the Warsaw Jewish ghetto, which occurred in waves between July and September of 1942. Franz's problem, however, was that they had copies of correspondence of his posted from Treblinka dated November 6, 1943, clearly putting paid to his defense. Day two of the trial was notable for a couple of events. One was the desire of the defendants to hide their faces from the cameras of journalists who were covering the trial. The second was the implosion of yet another of Franz's arguments, namely that he had never served as the deputy camp commander in Treblinka. Now, what's interesting is that many of Franz's colleagues turned against him at this point, his own fellow accused, and said, no, he was definitely the deputy commander. And when Stangl was outside of the camp, Franz was, in fact, the commander of the camp. The sixth day of the trial, moving forward, was one in which the court heard about the gassing of the Warsaw Jews at Treblinka. This was an episode recounted by one of the accused, Franz Zuckelmel, who described the successive raids that were conducted of the Treblinka, of the Warsaw Ghetto, when the Jews were rounded up between July and September of 1942 and sent to Treblinka. They were among the first victims at Treblinka, around 253,000 Warsaw Ghetto Jews. Well, as the court listened to this testimony, Franz continued to insist upon his innocence. And yet, he's almost Wile E. Coyote-like. It seems like every gambit that he makes, every attempt he makes to extricate himself from liability just blows up in his face. He claims that he had nothing to do with the killing, that he only performed innocent sorts of chores within the camp. But then they managed to find a document, which is then presented to the court. It's a promotion letter signed by no less a personage than Heinrich Himmler, indicating that Franz was being promoted from an NCO rank to a second lieutenant, a very rare promotion, by the way. Why? Because he was among the most meritorious of men serving Operation Reinhardt. And so it went. And from day to day, one defense after another blows up in Franz's face. I need to move ahead a bit. Apparently we're running out of time, and I have more to say, but I'm going to, in the interest of economy, timing and economy, I'm going to move ahead a bit and talk about Barry. the first several months of the trial really had focused to a great extent upon eyewitness testimony. Right? What happened in the camp? What was the nature of the responsibility and the contributions of the defendants to the killing carried out in the camp? But after month three, there's a shift in the court. The court increasingly now wants to clarify important issues that were raised during the trial, such as the issue involving duress. Were the men under pain of orders such that they had no choice to comply? You know, were they forced, in other words, to collaborate in genocide for fear of their lives? And this is an issue which had to be resolved, right? If in fact, the men were in a situation of duress, this is an absolute defense. And so witnesses were called to address this question. Another one that arose involved the dog Barry. I've mentioned Barry before. It was a St. Bernard mix. Witness after witness described the way that Franz used Barry to terrorize the prisoners. And yet other witnesses testified that Barry was a very peaceful and even loving dog who could be played with in the same way that you would play with your own dog at home. Right? So this is a contradiction that had to be resolved. Was Barry a violent, aggressive dog that ripped into the prisoners, or was he a peaceful, kind, and loving dog? In order to clarify this question, the court called on a world-famous ethologist, an animal behavioral theorist, named Konrad Lorenz. He took to the stand in order to address this question of how can Barry be at one and the same time a source of terror in the camp, but also a playful dog. For Lorenz, there really was no mystery. Right? St. Bernard mixes, he said, took on the characteristics of their master. So whatever person the dog identified with, the dog would reproduce the temperament of that person. Therefore, when the dog was with Franz, the dog became very aggressive. And when the dog was with other normal people who didn't commit genocide and mass murder, the dog was peaceful and loving. Okay? And so for Lorenz, there really was no mystery. There was no conundrum that had to be solved. Other witnesses testified as well on issues such as the duress issue that was determined that, in fact, there was no duress. There was never been a single case presented in which an SS man was ever punished for refusing to obey orders to kill Jews. So the court was satisfied that duress did not, in fact, exist. There was also some testimony from the head of the Munich Institute for Contemporary History in Munich, Hans Buchheim. Hans Buchheim was called upon to talk about a claim, another defense that was raised, concerning the legal status of Hitler's orders. Were Hitler's orders law in the Third Reich? Because if they were law, you're all lawyers or lawyers-to-be, right? If they're law, then the men acting under these orders thought that what they were doing was legal, right? And therefore, they lacked awareness of illegality, which is an essential element of convicting somebody under German law. So Buchheim took the stand and was asked this question: what was the status of Hitler's authority, of his legislative authority? He distinguished between two different levels of Hitler's authority, the extra-normative and the normative. Well, what was the normative? This is the level of Hitler's authority in which conventional domestic law was concerned, you know, conventional homicide law, contracts, you know, military matters, especially on the Western Front, where the Geneva Conventions were followed, the Hague Conventions were followed, the law of war was generally adhered to. But there was a contrast between this normative aspect of Hitler's authority and the extra-normative level, where Nazi ideology was the highest law, where ideologies that served the so-called historical mission of National Socialism in effect suspended the conventional legal realm. And the SS in particular was expected to act in accordance with Hitler's orders, knowing that they would not be held accountable for committing murder or mass murder so long as Hitler was in power and the Nazis controlled society. The key point here is that the homicide law continued intact, right? It was still illegal to kill people. It was just that these laws were suspended whenever the historical mission of National Socialism was required. So in this way, Buchheim was able to show that the men were, in fact, aware that what they were doing was illegal, clearly illegal and unethical and inhumane, and therefore they could be held accountable under the law for what they did. The end of the trial was really a resounding victory for the prosecution. The verdict was announced on the 94th day of the trial in September of 1965. All but one of the defendants was convicted. Three were convicted of murder as perpetrators. Right? In the old common law, that's a principle. Right? But in German, they're called Täter, principles. Six were convicted as accomplices. And then only one of them was acquitted, and that was because of lack of specific information or evidence tying him to crimes within the camp. The focus of the verdict, not surprisingly, was on Kurt Franz. He was blamed for much of the savagery and sadism within the camp. Interestingly enough, there was one fellow who was convicted, it was Willy Mintz, convicted as an accomplice, not as a perpetrator, but as an accomplice, which is unusual because he was given a life sentence even as an accomplice, and typically that was not done in German law at this time. So clearly the court felt that even though he was an accomplice, he should spend the rest of his days in jail. The trial was enormously successful, especially if we compare the outcome of Treblinka with Sobibor and Belzec. There were trials going on of these two camps as well. Belzec, 7 of 8 defendants were acquitted. Right? It was a complete failure for the prosecutor. Why? Because there was only one witness alive by 1963 when the court began, and there was just not enough evidence tying the men to specific acts which were necessary to convict them of homicide. Similarly, in Sobibor, about 50% were convicted, 50% acquitted. Again, fewer eyewitnesses available to tie the defendants to an actus reus, the old Latin expression, a criminal act. So why the disparity? I try to argue in my book that it goes all back to the availability of eyewitness testimony, and for that reason I gave my book a fairly pedestrian title, Eyewitness to Genocide, which really sums up for me the reason for the disparities in these cases. You had to have good, strong survivor witness testimony in order to make these charges stick, and they were able to accomplish this at Treblinka. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Michael Bryant, Associate Professor in the Department of History and Social Sciences at Bryant University in Smithfield, Rhode Island, and author of Confronting the Good Death, Nazi Euthanasia on Trial, 1945 to 1954. He delivered the International Law Lecture, co-sponsored by the Creighton International and Comparative Law Journal and International Law Society. His topic was Eyewitness to Genocide, the Operation Reinhardt Death Camp Trials, 1955 to 1966. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, April 9th, 2015, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Interim Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 400 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.